This podcast is brought to you by Coventry University. To find out more, visit www.coventry.ac.uk.
This is Shelley Joffrey from Panorama.
Hi.
She made her first or second long film with me.
A long time ago.
Second
wasn't
or first? She made a film with me on Stagecoach in Scotland. I'm a world expert on Stagecoach, the bus company. Don't ask me why, it's very sad, but I am. And I actually made five or six films with her. And Shelley made a Scottish one with me where we had a good time with lots of complaints to the BBC, which is always a good sign, isn't it?
Yeah, it's usually a sign you've done something right.
Yeah, they complained to the National Government of Scotland that we were daring to question their religion, which we weren't.
No.
And that we were, I can't remember some of the other complaints, but it fought off and it went out.
Yes.
And we made a film on St Mirren and the Football Club as well together. And we made a film during the Scottish election on New Lanark, and I can't remember what was the film about.
And we also made one about the chap who was trying to buy Noida, remember?
Oh, that's right. Yep. He was a complete con man.
Yep.
I can say that now. Trying to buy Noida, which is an island off Scotland, at the mainland. It's near Mallaig, who was a complete con man, and we proved that. And the guy trying to buy St Mirren was a con man. His company was set up in a public lavatory, or was it in East Anglia?
Something like that, yeah.
His company address he gave was actually a public lavatory in East Anglia, as we discovered by finding it.
So we claim that we saved Noida and we saved St Mirren, didn't
yeah,
we?
I'm yeah. not sure. Shelley works out of Scotland. She's come out from Glasgow today. She's made a whole series of films about Sir Oxap, which some of you will have seen over the last 8 years on Panorama. Has actually changed public policy or changed commercial policy on Sir Oxap through those films, just through sheer determination and just being a terrier. Is a terrier the right dog?
That's what my mother says.
Yeah, anyway, a terrier, yeah. Just not giving up on the bone and just biting and biting and biting. And you've got one going out in a week's time, is that Sir Oxap?
Monday the 12th of November, it's about ADHD medication. So it's not Sir Oxap, but it is another medication story. So. Don't miss
today,
it.
So everything today is on the record, by the way. There are some journalism students here who are taking notes, and we would expect to see their stories in papers, so as long as you know that. Right, how did you find this story?
Well, I read a little bit in a newspaper in about 2000 that sort of seemed a bit intriguing. It was, I think it was actually patients' complaints about the drugs, about Sir Oxap, and I think some people were complaining it was quite difficult to withdraw from and were suggesting that it was addictive. So I had just started on Panorama at that stage, and I made a few phone calls, thought there's definitely a story here. Couldn't persuade my editor at the time to go with it, and went off and made another film about tranquilizer addiction, which turned out to be quite useful because I suppose really what it turned out to be was the same story, the modern day story of SSRI antidepressants like Sir Oxap is actually what happened.
Did you explain what SSRI is?
The selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, if you want the full. But it's a class of antidepressant, which includes Sir Oxap, Prozac, Sertraline. They all kind of work in the same way. And the story that I investigated on tranquilizer addiction was pretty much what seemed to be happening now with SSRIs, because people had become terribly addicted to benzodiazepine tranquilizers like Valium and Mogadon back in the 70s. And these new antidepressants were supposed to be cleaner, safer, non-addictive drugs that, you know, replaced the old antidepressants. But after I'd finished the benzodiazepine tranquilizer story, which helped me kind of find my feet and learn how the pharmaceutical industry worked and learn a bit more about the intricacies of medical research, it gave me quite a good head start when then finally my editor said, okay, let's have a look at the antidepressant story.
You want to come around this way, you find a seat there, it's a Carol show.
Let's have a look at the antidepressant story. And so that's what I did. And after a bit of research, we decided, although there are problems with the whole class of drugs, we decided to kind of narrow down on Sir Oxap for a number of reasons. One, because it's made by GlaxoSmithKline, which is Britain's largest drug company, the second largest drug company in the world. But two, mainly because as well as the problems with suicidal thinking. These were the allegations that were made about all the whole class of drugs, was that if you try and come off these drugs or if you start on too high a dose, some people might become suicidal, might self-harm, might even become very aggressive, even homicidal. That was true for the whole class of drugs, but Ciroxa also seemed to have a unique problem with withdrawal because it was a longer acting drug. So for all of these reasons, we decided to try and focus the research into this one particular drug, and that's what the starting point
was. How long
was.
Did it take you to make the first film?
The first film took the best part of a year, actually. I was doing some work on it while working on another film, and then really solidly for about 8 months. And you know, it took a lot of digging.
To make a 50-minute film took you 8 months.
Yeah.
Was it 50 minutes then? 40.
It was 40 minutes. This one was 40 minutes.
Yes.
And you know, it was quite difficult because we knew we were taking on the second largest drug company in the world, which is not something that you do lightly. This was a drug that was at the time earning them $2 billion a year, which is just sort
in profit or in revenue?
In revenue.
Yeah.
You know, but it was their sort of cash cow, their wonder drug. Such a lot rode on this one particular drug for the company that you think, well, you know, you're always careful when you do an investigation, but I think we need to be extra especially careful about what we're seeing here. And also we had to be very careful because so many people were taking this drug. Vulnerable people, people suffering from depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, social anxiety, all sorts of illnesses where if you make some big bold claim that actually turns out to be not quite right, you might have forced, you know, thousands of people to stop taking a medication that they really needed. So all of this was really looming large in our heads when we were deciding how to proceed. And, you know, we proceeded very carefully with it.
At which stage did you talk to the lawyers? Was it Scottish lawyers or London lawyers?
It was the London lawyers. I was making this from London at the time, with a London-based production team. And, we were talking to the lawyer the whole way through the production, because the first programme pretty much relied on the testimony of one man, who was Dr. David Healy, who's a psychiatrist based in Bangor in North Wales. And what was unique about his position was he, through a series of legal actions in the United States, had actually been given access to GlaxoSmithKline's secret archives in the States, which was just this absolute wealth of confidential material that nobody in this country has any right to look at. It's all considered proprietary, you know, sensitive, commercially sensitive information. So all the results of trials that they had run even before the drug had been licensed, there was acres and acres of this stuff. And he was allowed, through American litigation, to go over to Philadelphia to GlaxoSmithKline's archives and look through all of this. He only had, I think to memory, it was 3 days to sit and try and work out from this vast archive what he should look at. But what he did it very systematically. He took notes, but it's so confidential. He wasn't even able to show me his notes. He wasn't able to tell me a lot of what he had actually seen. The only way we could really proceed, he could tell me what he had told the court in America, and then he was covered. But not everything else he could be prosecuted.
So there was privilege. He could only tell you what he told the court, and beyond that, it wasn't privilege.
Yeah, and so that's pretty much how we had to. There were a lot of claims that patients were making about the drug, but we had to, I think, particularly in the first program, because this was, you know, you hear anecdotal reports, but how can you be sure unless you've got something to back it up? Well, here was some evidence, but we had to trust that this man was telling us the truth. And in some regards, we took a punt on the fact that he'd been through a court case in America. This man had successfully sued GlaxoSmithKline in Wyoming, claiming that the drug had prompted his father-in-law to kill his mother-in-law, his wife, and his baby daughter. He kind of went into a homicidal rage, having taken only two Ciroxa. And so all the evidence was heard
So you'll probably find a seat better if you come over this way. Sorry, Shelley.
That's okay. All the evidence was heard in open court, and actually the jury found against GlaxoSmithKline in that case. They found them to be 80% responsible for the deaths of these three people. So in the course of the court proceedings, Dr. Healy, the one thing that I thought was really compelling evidence that he talked about in court, because the problem when you're talking about depressed patients is that the drug company always says, well, it wasn't our drug that made him kill himself or it made him a homicidal maniac, it was his depression. How do you separate out the two? Well, what Dr. Healy had found was the tests that GlaxoSmithKline had done on healthy volunteers. You know, people who work for the company, and these tests are done by all drug companies before they get a drug licensed, because for the very reason that it separates out the effects of the illness from the effects of the drug. Because if you're not depressed, then why on earth would you become suicidal, you know, within days of taking this drug? So what he had found in the healthy volunteer studies was that it was making some people have suicidal thoughts and become aggressive. And also that even within a very short space of time of taking the drug, a lot of them were having difficulty withdrawing from it. So we found that was really the most compelling evidence that we used in the programme, as well as we had some good case studies as well. But you know, you're very much aware of the fact that you're sort of almost putting your eggs in one basket with this man.
But like all good investigative journalists, you found an obsessive.
Yes.
The trick is to find an obsessive who's got a dossier, they usually call it, don't they?
Yeah.
And he actually had a dossier.
Yeah, and you need somebody like that, because there is literally no way of getting this information. I've got no legal right in this country to, you know, freedom of information or anything at all. You can't say, please, can you show me your healthy volunteer studies? You've got no right to see them, and you need to find somebody who can get to them. And it's funny because American lawyers are often dismissed as ambulance chasers, but it was only because of this American litigation that people got to find out the truth about what the company had known for years. And remember, these studies were done 20 years ago. That's the thing. This is information that had been around for a very long time, but hadn't been, even after patients started complaining of this very effect from the drug, they were dismissed as, you know, well, you're ill.
GlaxoSmithKline would have had a dossier on Dr. Healy as well, wouldn't they? Did they try and rubbish him to you? Did you get phone calls saying this man's very unstable? Did you get
it? It's actually more straightforward than that. I mean, they said when I interviewed the representative from GlaxoSmithKline, I mean, I've done three interviews with him now. He would say on camera that Dr. Healy wasn't to be trusted. You know, that what did he know? But funnily enough, they never sued Dr. Healy for anything that he ever said, which gave me a certain amount of confidence that if they had wanted to stop him talking about it, they probably would have. I think what was more insidious was, and you know, you don't know where this ever begins, but speaking to other psychiatrists, other members of the medical community, they go, you know that David Healy's a nut, don't you? You know he's a maverick. You know, I mean, you can't believe a thing that he says. And, that's quite, you've got to really be firm about your facts and what it is you're doing when people are whispering that sort of thing ear.
When we made our film on Stagecoach, the whisper came to the control of BBC Scotland, and one of our interviewees was a sex maniac. It turned out he'd actually once written a letter to some soft porn magazine.
I'd forgotten about that.
But the whisper was, this man is a sex maniac, why are you interviewing him?
Yeah.
So you kept your resolve and trusted him. Mm-hmm. And then the programme went out. How many emails did you get in response?
Well, we had a helpline. There were 67,000 phone calls to the helpline in the week after the programme went out. We got 1,500 emails, which is kind of pretty unprecedented. And this was, you know, 5 years ago when people weren't all quite so email literate. And lots of letters as well. And I mean, I was swamped by it. I sort of, you know, I felt we were on to something. But as soon as this all started flooding in, then, and it was story after story after story saying, oh my God, that happened to me. I had no idea it was happening to anyone else. I told my doctor, he said, you're crazy. He just upped the dose, I felt worse. It was just story after story after story. And then, I mean, for a few weeks, I just thought, well, gosh, that's quite dramatic. And then the more I read through the emails in particular, because you can, you know, you can keep going back to them, I thought we have to find some systematic way of harnessing. This is the story. This is people telling us their stories. What can we do about it? Because, for example, in the first programme, another avenue that I pursued but didn't really get home on in the first programme was about the effect the drug was having on children. And I had found we had this one published clinical trial paper with a study that's come to be known as Study 329, where basically they tested Ceroxat on depressed children. And the published article, published in a very prestigious American journal, says that the drug is generally safe and effective in depressed children. And it was only because I had a very long plane journey over to Philadelphia and nothing to do that I, because, you know, medical journal articles that can be really, really dry. And this one was particularly hard to read. But I kept reading it over and over again. Every time I read the data, it looked to me like, although they were saying it was safe and effective, there were like 10 kids who'd been on Ceroxat out of 90 who'd been hospitalized in 8 weeks on the trial. I mean, that sounded like a hell of a lot to me. And I went over to interview the man who'd helped conduct this study, and he's like, no, the drug's fine, it's, you know. And I'm not a doctor, I'm not medically trained. I was sort of trying to ring, well, I remember ringing Dr. Healy and saying, have you seen this paper? And he said, no, you'll have to bring it back and I'll have a look at it. And, you know, even he had to read it a few times before he kind of could see what the problem was. But then you're faced with, well, hang on, this has been published in a medical journal. It's been peer reviewed. Yeah. You know, he might agree with me that it looks like something fishy's gone on here, but it's been through so, how could it have got through so many levels of, because, you know, academic medicine is what basically persuades doctors which pills they should prescribe, but it couldn't have got through all of this and be wrong. You know, am I just mad? But then when these emails and phone calls came in, we had about 20 from children and their parents, and actually they were the most shocking, because it almost seemed clear cause and effect for them. You know, I mean, as an adult, we all lead complicated lives, lots of things happen, and, you know, sometimes it can be difficult to disentangle what caused what. But here were kids who were telling their story. They'd been a bit, you know, depressed or down about some life event, had never self-harmed, had never been thinking of suicide, hallucinating about murdering people. And then within a few days or a few weeks of starting on the drug, this was what was happening to them. So that was hugely compelling. I mean, in the first program, I just couldn't find cases like that, because it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. But they came to Panorama after they saw the program, because they so clearly recognised.
So out of the 1,500 emails, there were at least 20 stories you could have told. At least 20.
Yeah. And so then we hooked up with two medical researchers and said, look, can you do something with this data? So they sort of basically systematically went through it all and helped write it into a medical paper that was eventually published. But we also sent out a kind of, we worked with Mind, the mental health charity, and drew up a questionnaire that we sent back to, as you know, pretty much everybody that we could, and asked them to fill it in, and quite a large number of them filled it in, and then it allowed us to say just something a little more definite about what these people's experiences had been, and that helped form the spine of the second programme, which also took us a very critical look at the system of how you report side effects from a medication in this country, because the whole, you know, the system that was set up after the thalidomide tragedy, and it was supposed to make sure nothing like this could ever happen again. Doctors were meant to send in yellow cards whenever they just even suspected a drug to have caused a side effect. But it was quite clear that this system was completely inadequate and was totally failing to spot big problems with medication, and because doctors were the gatekeeper, and if doctors didn't believe what the patient had to say, they wouldn't send in the cards. So they were just never hearing about this problem. So we poked at that in the second program
But you said you're not a doctor. I mean, are you an imposter? You're taking on a big drug company which is selling huge numbers of his pills. You got no medical treatment. You're a journalist. You know, you went to Stirling University. You didn't do medicine, as far as I know.
I did not. I wasn't any good at chemistry at school either. But
did you think?
Well,
I'm out of my depth here.
There were quite a few times where I thought I was out of my depth, but you know, I just thought, well, you have to stick to what you can prove, what you can demonstrate here. And actually, I think my confidence grew after the first programme because so many people seemed to verify what it was we had said. But my confidence also, I mean, you know, that there are a lot of arrogant doctors out there who feel that they know best. And once I started scratching away at that, they would say to me, well, you know, these are all anecdotes. You know, what you need to look at is randomised controlled clinical trials. These are the gold standard in terms of evidence. We practice evidence-based medicine. But actually, as I started to peel back the layers of it all, like looking at this one particular trial, which I've kept on plugging away at until so really the last programme I made on this in January was wholly looking at this one clinical trial. And what it showed was that the doctors, medical journals, everybody is having the wool pulled over their eyes because drug companies discovered a long, long time ago how to harness the tools that most persuade doctors. They know that doctors aren't stupid. Sending a drug rep in who, you know, like me, probably doesn't even have a medical background, isn't going to just, you know, or a free pen, that's not really going to be what persuades a doctor to prescribe your drug. What will persuade them is an article in a respected journal, is the head of Harvard's psychiatry department standing up at a prestigious medical conference and telling them. And how do, you know, so it's much more insidious. They've realised how to harness the whole
process. They were planting
process.
Papers, essentially, were they? They were planting papers.
Well, I mean, is that how I would describe planting papers? I mean,
they were encouraging papers to appear which were positive.
The process that on this one particular clinical trial, study 329, that once I had unpeeled it all, it became clear that what happened was, I think that the people who had carried out the study for them, some of them whom were very eminent psychiatrists, had done it, I think, in good faith. But the way that the system operates now is that very often the person who you see as author of a paper didn't actually write it at all. So, you know, you would think that this person would scrutinise all the data and do all the numbers, but somebody else does that. Somebody else who works for the drug company does that. And so it's not as simple as, you know, you pay a guy a load of money just to write whatever you want them to write. I think they probably did it in good faith, but didn't insist that they saw all the data. So in this clinical trial, and then there becomes a way of writing things up that, because in fact, it was this one phrase that first rang alarm bells when I read this study 5 years ago, was they kept talking about children suffering from emotional lability. And I didn't, I mean, I don't know if anyone, do you know what?
Lability.
Emotional lability.
What's lability? What's the word?
Does anyone know that?
What does the word lability mean?
It meant they were suicidal.
Right.
But so what they do, they get a ghostwriter, they get a medical writer, somebody who's used to putting a shine on things, who's used to, you know, sort of polishing up the rough diamond. And so obviously, if you put it in the paper that, you know, 10 kids became suicidal, people think, oh my God, I'm not going to prescribe that. Emotionally labile, well, no, I don't think anybody knew. David Healy didn't know what that meant when I rang him. I asked various other doctors, they didn't know what it meant. So what, you know, and that was, you know, I can't help but think that must have been done for a reason. And when it came to another thing I discovered when I kind of poured through it in detail was, so when it came to writing up the side effects that the drug might have caused on this 1 8-week trial, the kids on Ceroxat, I think there were 11 serious side effects which may have been caused by Ceroxat. Well, the ghostwriter turns the whole thing around and says only one side effect was definitely caused by Ceroxat, and that was a headache. So, so instead of warning the people who were reading this paper that 10 kids might have become suicidal, self-harmed, become you know, really aggressive, what they told them at the end of the day in the paper, which wasn't strictly a lie, it just wasn't, you know...
It wasn't the complete truth. Economical the truth.
Yeah, was that, you know, there's a small chance a child might have a headache on this drug.
Or commit suicide. So, but by this point, though, GlaxoSmithKline have probably established a Shelley Joffrey unit, haven't they?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. It was only in the final programme, you know, because I didn't approach this all. I never meant to make four programmes about it. I thought I would make one programme and move on. But you just keep, you know, it was just too compelling. It just felt every time I was sort of getting somewhere, then a little bit more information would become apparent. And so you just have to keep going with it. So, but even naively, I assumed, for example, that these academics I'm telling you about who were named on this paper, this clinical trial, it was funded by GlaxoSmithKline, but I didn't believe because they were all head of department at prestigious American universities. I didn't believe that they would be beholden to GlaxoSmithKline. Even after my first program, I didn't appreciate that. I didn't understand that. And it was only this final program where, through another legal action, this Californian legal team's got a whole box of documents that, you know, they had to fight tooth and nail basically to get as many as they have into the public domain. But some of them, which, you know, they showed me, were about me. And I hadn't quite appreciated how, you know, and there were leaflets that were being sent out internally to GlaxoSmithKline dismissing what I had said and not to believe me. And this was all like, you know, kind of media scaremongering. But the most compelling emails for me were the ones from these academics writing to GlaxoSmithKline saying, how am I going to deal with this woman? And I was astonished to discover that, because I really thought these people, as head of departments and prestigious universities, wouldn't want to be that involved with a drug company. But I was wrong, because I think that's just the way academic medicine, particularly in America, but increasingly all over the world, that's the way academic medicine is run now. The person who can pull in the biggest research grants from the pharmaceutical companies is usually the top guy now.
So it's log rolling, is it? You put your name to that paper, We'll make sure you get some research money for something else, or even for that drug.
Well, I wasn't able to. It's so difficult to disentangle because the whole thing is so intertwined now. So, for example, when I've been twice to the American Psychiatric Association conference, which is like the biggest congregation of psychiatrists in the world, 20,000 psychiatrists from around the world. All.
What's the collective name?
I know. I wouldn't like to say it on the record. Yeah, and that's where they meet up, and they have these drug funded symposiums. So like one of the authors of this paper that I featured in my program, he was speaking at a drug funded symposium. But if you say, did GlaxoSmithKline pay you to speak here? No, the American Psychiatric Association paid them. Who paid them? GlaxoSmithKline. So everything's kind of, it's really difficult to unpick who's paying who and who's beholden to who and where the money comes from for everything. But it's, in fact, you know, I still don't know after 7 years of looking at this exactly how to do that, because increasingly medical journals are demanding transparency, for example, from authors of medical papers. But what does that amount to? So now at the end you get a list that's, you know, a page long of, you know, Dr. So-and-so got money from GSK, Pfizer, Eli Lilly. But then most doctors do now. And most people in academic medicine have to take money from drug companies to get research done. So how do you work out the difference between the guy who's beholden to the drug company and the guy who has just basically taken the bare minimum in order to get his job done? I mean, the only advice I could give on that is to try and scratch beneath the surface. If they're on the speaker's bureau, if they're a consultant, if they're a paid consultant, then, you know, that the more money they're getting paid, the more beholden they tend to be to the drug company. It's difficult to criticise anyone these days for taking a research grant, because that's how about 80% of research gets done. But you wouldn't know by looking at the list of potential conflict of interest at the end. You need to dig deeper than that to try and work out who might
be
tainted.
Let's talk about you, where you work. Who does your research for you?
Well, me. Me and whoever I'm working with.
You and a producer?
Yeah.
You're a Murdoch in this case,
yeah? Yeah. Well, actually, it wasn't Murdoch this time. I mean, I've worked with three different producers on four programmes and various researchers as well. So I'm probably the only kind of constant in the investigation. But whenever we sort of embark together, we do the research together. And it's there's not really a... We're just sort of a team, so we all dig away together, and if the researcher comes up with something good, it's, you know, that's fine. That's just, we all dig away together.
The story is in your head, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah.
You are the world's expert on Xerox.
You might say that. I've become a Xerox anorak, that's for sure. And my mother keeps saying, are you going to make a programme about something else? But
I was going to ask you, have you become a one or two trick pony, haven't you?
Well... You know, as I said earlier, I didn't mean to make so many programmes, but there's just so much in it. There's so much in it, and although, you know, you could call them Xerox at 1, 2, 3, and 4, I mean, there's been a different emphasis in all of them, and so like the third programme really tried to take the medicines regulator to task, because I think programmes 1 and 2 left you in no doubt what GlaxoSmithKline had known and had failed to tell doctors and the public. But then it begs the question, what on earth is our medicines regulator doing? So the Xeroxat story helped us through that, but what it did was just illustrate what was wrong with the regulator generally. And I think was responsible for some wholesale overhaul of the system, although it's difficult to completely overhaul it because the medicines regulator is fully funded by industry. So, you know, there's always a question mark about how rigorous, how independent the regulator can be. I mean, at the moment, after the last programme, they invited me in and they have the sort of evidence that I uncovered in the last programme. And they are conducting a criminal investigation into GlaxoSmithKline. But that's actually been going on for 3 years since the second programme.
Who's doing that? The medicine regulator?
Yeah.
With the police, with the police as well, yeah?
Well, they have to decide, first of all, whether they think there is a criminal case that GlaxoSmithKline acted fraudulently by not revealing what it knew about the children's clinical trials sooner than it did. But this has been going on for 3 years. They still haven't reached any conclusion. I'd like to think it's going to be extremely rigorous, but I'm not holding my breath that criminal charges are going to be brought against the second largest drug company in the world, which employs huge numbers of people in this country and routinely, I think, threatens to take their business elsewhere if we impose too much regulation on them.
Do GlaxoSmithKline take your calls these days?
They're always very polite.
You get the same person.
To be fair to GlaxoSmithKline, when I have done other stories about pharmaceutical companies, the easiest thing for them, I think, would have been just not to cooperate. They didn't have to participate in one programme, never mind three. They put, you know, their European Director of Clinical Safety up 3 times to be interviewed, and I think increasingly...
He must hate you.
Well, he's always very civil when we meet, but it was starting to get a bit embarrassing. But you know, we've always given them a fair chance, I think, as well, to refute all the allegations that we've made. So they've always had a fair hearing on the programmes, as far as I'm concerned. And while obviously you do have to deal with a lot of legal letters, it never got, you know, unduly heavy.
They complained to the BBC or complaints, or have they done anything legal at all?
They've never sued us, no.
Have they threatened to?
No. Which, again, I think, well, gives me a certain amount of confidence that we were not wrong. But after the first programme, they probably assumed, like I did, that it was all over and we wouldn't do another programme. And so nobody complained about the programme until we contacted them just before the second programme, and they sort of said, oh, but the last one was terribly, terribly unfair. But I think they were trying to find a reason not to participate in the second one. But, they did participate and sort of took it on the chin. And they took a very different tack the second time. I mean, literally, the same man looks kind of completely different. In the second program, he's taken his tie off, loosened his collar, cocked his head to one side.
And he's had PR advice, hasn't
yes,
he?
Exactly, and talks very, you know, and as a doctor myself, I, you know, I would never want to harm patients and blah, blah, you know. So they realised, I think, they had an image problem by the time the second programme came round and responded to that.
Did it work?
Well, it worked. Did it work? No, well, actually, I mean, I think...
You still toasted him, come on.
No, I didn't. Yeah. But
you didn't mind his collar was on there. You still gave him a good toast.
If I'm being honest, what I hadn't anticipated, because the first interview with him had been such a kind of combative affair, I was sort of expecting just to start off round two just like that, and so it was slightly unnerving. So in that respect, it probably worked for the first few minutes, where he's speaking very gently with his head to one side and saying, having listened to patients, we've decided that they didn't really understand the advice that you cannot become addicted to Ciroxat. So we're going to reword that now. And, you know, which, so he made it sound very much like, you know, they were caring, sharing, and it wasn't anything to do with us. It was all to do with them listening to patients. But but then we kind of got into the meat of it, and I think...
And you gave him a toaster.
Well...
I can say that. You can't say that. Before we get off the three, four programmes, any questions on Ciroxat? Yes, young lady. Make it a question, please.
I used to be on venlafaxine. It's not Ciroxat, is it, as well?
No, venlafaxine's effects, or there are problems... There are problems with it in terms of withdrawal problems as well. It's one of the most complained about medicines in terms of withdrawal problems.
I know. I have that, but it wasn't like bad like the Ciroxat. It's just like
playing
with stress. What about...
She's not a doctor, remember? She's not a doctor.
No, but
that's
as well.
Hang on. Jeff, put up there.
Negative, well, non-publication negative results from medicine, which is obviously a big problem.
Yeah.
I'll repeat the question for the sake of the podcast. Non-publication of negative results is a big problem in medical research. Have you had other examples in the course of your work?
I mean, there are loads. there are lots. And in fact, you know, you were asking me if we've become a one-trick pony. I think one of the things I've sort of tried to avoid, because I think you could probably make a career out of looking at what drug companies know and don't tell you about their drugs.
But Carla Richmond has, didn't you?
Well, but it becomes, I mean, for me, it's probably less satisfying. I pursued this Ciroxat one because I really felt I was sort of getting somewhere, both in terms of revealing exactly what the drug company knew and didn't tell, but also, as I say, about the system of medicines regulation, about the way academic medicine works. But if I was to start at the beginning again on quite a few of these drugs, that would probably feel to me like going over old ground. But I would certainly say for all of you who are thinking about doing any stories, well, I routinely speak to other journalists. You know, call me up and email me all the time and say, hey, what about this drug? What have you heard? And I'll point them in the right direction if I have heard
but
something.
Do you own the Ciroxat story? Do you feel proprietorial if somebody else comes in and does something about it?
I feel, well, I suppose, yes, it feels like sort of my baby, if you like, but I don't have it, you know, I think some other people have done, like Sarah Bosley on The Guardian's done some fantastic work, you know.
She's your friend, isn't she?
No, she's not. No, we were quite competitive in the sort of telling of the story, because newspapers, of course, can get a story in the paper the next day, whereas you're trying to hold on to some nugget of information for 6 months so that you can broadcast it all in one go in a television programme. So no, actually, you know, newspaper journalists are usually sort of nipping at your heels. So, but she's done some terrific work on Ciroxat and other drugs like Herceptin, and you know, there are a lot of stories out there because the drug companies increasingly are sort of fighting for a diminishing sort of share of the market. It's been a long time since there were any, you know, so lots of blockbuster drugs.
A big discovery like Ciroxat is a cash cow.
Of course it is. Yeah. Of course it is. And then once once they've exploited the adult market, that's when they look at new ways to, you know, to sell the drug. Oh, right, we can sell it to children. You know, we can sell it for hot flushes and menopausal women. I just did a search yesterday on Google because I was coming here today to see what they were saying about it recently. And well, there's a new illness that I had never heard of, which is prenatal depression. Apparently, Seroxat is good for prenatal depression, which, have you heard of that yet? Well, watch this space. I think it's coming to the UK soon, because whatever starts in America usually comes here eventually.
PN, the gentleman in the back.
It's to do with the ghostwriting and rent-a-quote. Do you think that's explained in part by trust, or mutual trust, or misplaced trust?
Ghostwriting of medical articles, is it down to misplaced trust?
The thing, most even, you know, people that I respect in the medical community after years of working on this story, most of them will say that there is nothing wrong with ghostwriting per se. That so, as well, there's nothing wrong with somebody polishing up your article for you. I suppose ghostwriting is probably the wrong term, because they say it should be acknowledged. Their contribution to the article should be made clear. So if all they did was just, you know, write it in better language, then that should be made clear. But very often it's not. And if the person who's named as the lead author didn't look at the data, then they should make that clear as well. Although I don't think it would be published if they made that clear, because that, you know, that would be a problem. I know that people, everybody's got a different moral compass, I suppose, and what they're prepared to accept. And it's the same in any walk of life. What you will do for money, to what will you do to earn a few extra bucks on top of your day job, and I suppose how much trust you have in the people that you speak to, who will probably be very plausible.
If GSK would come to you and say, hey, Shelley, all this Panadol stuff is nonsense, here's 100,000 a year to become our head of PR, what would you say?
I would have to say no. My mum asked me that question.
Yes.
I would have to say.
Is your mum an MSP?
She was an MSP. She's retired now.
Scottish Parliament.
But no, I wouldn't. But I know plenty of people who have as well. I mean, you know, that was one of the interesting things over the course of 5 or 6 years. I would see people, you know, the press officer from the medicines regulator, then the next time I did the story would turn up as a press officer for GlaxoSmithKline, and, you know, the head of safety for GlaxoSmithKline then would turn up as the head of licensing at the medicines regulator. So there's this whole revolving door. Sorry, that's not quite the question you asked, but
can you be bought? That was a question. Can you be bought by GSK?
Well, or you wanted to know whether other people, yeah. How other people are bought.
I wanted to know whether you could.
Well, no, I would say no until obviously the day that I take the money and you can throw that back at me. No, I have absolutely no inclination to work for a drug company.
Other questions on Seroxat and the Panorama? Yes.
Excuse me, when your program was broadcast,
was your program approved by a medical doctor before it was broadcast?
The view, you mean, so when you talk about the side effect of the drug, did you get any doctor share your view?
You had Dr. Healy, but did the lawyers insist on you getting a medical?
No, that's a really interesting question, and which is kind of at the core of everything that I've been doing when I've been looking through this story, because I remember in the very first programme, we were very aware of what the effect of this might be on the patients, as I said at the beginning, because you're dealing with a very, very vulnerable group of people. So then what do you do? You're revealing something shocking to people that you believe to be true, and you think that you've got some firm evidence. The healthy volunteer studies, I felt, were very compelling evidence that even in healthy people, this drug can be addictive, and it can make you suicidal, self-harming, and aggressive. So that was the central argument. But then there's this pressure not to be alarmist. So then you end up having to say, but you shouldn't stop taking your medication without first seeking medical advice. Well, whose advice do you seek? Whose advice do you send? I mean, we had to put that advice on the programme, but the doctors believe the medical journal articles that have been ghostwritten by the PR company that have the name of the Harvard psychiatrist at the top of it, but none of them actually know the truth. The person who knows the truth is this one man in North Wales who's had the courage to talk about what he saw in GlaxoSmithKline's secret archive. But you can't tell the audience all to ring David Healy and ask them whether he should, you know, whether they should, and he doesn't particularly, I'm sure, want that responsibility anyway. But it's a perpetual problem with these stories, because who would I ring other than the man who had actually seen the evidence with his own eyes? Because so all these doctors I would meet after the first program and go, "That's rubbish." Well, how do you know it's rubbish? What is it that you've seen? Well, you know, I've treated patients and they haven't had a problem. Right, okay, but isn't that why you do clinical trials? Yes, it is. Well, what I'm telling you is that this man has seen the results, the real results of the clinical trials, and this is the truth. So you go round and round in circles trying to, you know, trying to convince people, but you've got to be responsible. Although part of me thinks the responsible thing is to say, maybe you shouldn't take this drug, but you can't say that, because if something terrible happens, then it's, you know.
Has Healy never let you down in 7 years? Is all his information has been accurate?
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah, and I think as the. Well, the then head of the Royal College of Psychiatrists said in the third programme, you know, he's had his day now. I think he has been completely vindicated. Again, I'd like to say that the medical community were all kind of, you know, falling over themselves to say, sorry that we didn't believe you, sorry that we, you know, whispered about you behind your back. But I think, I don't think he would particularly mind me saying it, because I think he knows it to be true. He's still regarded as a maverick, and there's still a whispering campaign about him, even though, you know, now the drug is banned for under 18s. It's only supposed to be prescribed for more severe depression in adults, you know, so they've really rationalised how it should be prescribed. The system of the yellow card adverse effect reporting system has been completely overhauled. All the things that he pointed out and was talking about from 1999, he's been shown to be right about.
But you haven't only found one obsessor, you found a second one, this woman in the Malibu beach house. This must be, you won the lottery twice in your life. She's got this huge collection, hasn't she?
Yeah.
You must have walked in and thought, nirvana.
Well, I mean, these things, yeah, it evolved, though, because I got to know the legal company in America, because they were the company that got David Healy in to look at the secret archive. And so then you develop this bond with them. And then, you know, for me as a journalist, the information that I started picking away at on children in Soroxat, they didn't know. And David Healy didn't know. So I kind of brought something to them, which they were able to kind of keep looking into. And then, you know, that's the way these things work. When you do long-term investigations, you start to build up relationships with people, and you help them and they help you. And sort of, you know, if you're both looking at the same thing, if you're lucky, sometimes it coincides. And you know, you can both do some good together, which is probably what motivates me more than...
Any more Soroxat questions? Yes.
You mentioned various experts that you spoke to. One group you haven't mentioned is statisticians. I mean, a lot of your data, one of the stuff that you've looked at, must be numerical data. You employed any statisticians, and particularly did you ask them about things like confidence levels and that sort of thing, particularly to deciding if results are statistically meaningful or not?
Well, I didn't employ statisticians, and this will be, you know, that I think this is probably more where my journalistic instinct takes over, because when I looked at the study 329 5 years ago and said, it looks like there's something really dodgy going on here, lots of people told me, but it's not statistically significant and blah, blah, blah. And no matter how many people told me that, oh, no, this is fine, it's not...
The question you have to ask then is, what's the confidence levels?
Well, what my confidence level was if you put 90 children on a drug for a very short period of time, 8 weeks is a very short period of time, and you compare it to a sugar pill, which is, that's the whole point of carrying out controlled trials, and it was actually 7 of them had to be hospitalized, 10 of them had very serious psychiatric side effects, but 7 of them had to go to hospital, and I think only 1 on sugar pill had to go to hospital. That says to me there's a problem, and I think sometimes that's the problem. Like in the any closed community that you start looking at, I've done a lot of work on fingerprints, for example, and fingerprints experts will always say to me, well, what do you know about fingerprints? You're not a fingerprint expert. And doctors will say, what do you know about, clinically controlled trials and statistics? You're not, you've never trained medically. But sometimes it's just the simple question that you keep on asking that, the medicines regulator should have been asking, that the head of psychiatry should have been asking, and they weren't asking that. And actually, eventually, when somebody got around to asking that question, they discovered that, that I was right, that it was, that there was a problem. And it was blindingly obvious there was a problem, but nobody wanted to see it.
Your second trick pony is you freed the Scottish policewoman, didn't you?
Well, she was free, but she was. This is a policewoman, Shirley McKee, who was falsely accused of leaving her fingerprint at a crime scene, and it's quite a complicated story. But essentially, she lost her job and was sort of branded a liar and shunned by Strathclyde police. And this story has rumbled on in Scotland for a very long time. And again, it was just asking some simple questions that eventually we were able to show that in fact she told the truth, and that she'd had the kind of whole weight of the police and sort of establishment against her, but in fact she had been telling the truth all along. But there were some people who didn't welcome me looking into that, because as far as they were concerned, this was nothing to do with anyone other than people in fingerprinting. And if you've never sat for years looking through a magnifying glass at bifurcations and ridges, what do you know? You can't come and tell us anything about the way we do things. But the way they were doing things was wrong, and eventually we managed to demonstrate that. So that mean sometimes I think a fresh eye who doesn't just ask the same old questions is what you need to get things moving on a story like this. Because the thing that really depresses me about the Ceroxat story is that, this is a drug that was on the market, 16, 17 years it's now been on sale. And really only the truth about it started to come out just as it was about to come off patent and stop being so lucrative to the drug company. In fact, it matters much less to GlaxoSmithKline now than it would have done had this story been shown to be true at the beginning of the drug's life. And you have to say how many people went through a miserable, miserable time because the drug company chose not to tell people what they knew about it. I mean, obviously some people have a good experience with this drug. I mean, nobody's ever denied that. But if they had been very honest about what the risks of taking it and what the risks of stopping taking it would be, I think a lot less people would have taken the drug. And of course, that's, I think, what the number one priority is, to get as many people to take your drug as possible.
So, Roxette, question back? You had a go, sorry. Do you have any views on whether GPs in the UK are
overtrained and so equal at more for wearing a little lockdown so that you
Are GPs trained enough to
I think it's a big problem, because GPs, are enormously busy as it is, and they have to rely on their, their British National Formulary or whatever, and sort of up-to-date bulletins that come round every so often saying, hang on, we're revising our guidance on this, that, or the other. I mean, the story that I've got that's going out on the 12th of November is an interesting one, because it's looking at ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder medication. Now, there's an estimated 500,000 children in Britain have ADHD. We've discovered at least 55,000 kids are prescribed ADHD medication by their GPs. So that's not even counting the ones who are prescribed it by direct from paediatricians and psychiatrists. So, you know, there's a lot of children on this medication. It's very potent, powerful medication that can have serious side effects, can stunt their growth. It's even been linked to suicidal thoughts, you know, sleeplessness, all sorts of things. So it's not something any parent would enter into lightly, but their GP, they go on the advice that they've got, which is, well, this should be really the first line treatment. Don't bother with behavioural therapy. Don't bother with parenting classes. This medication will really make a big difference to your child, and it's based on a big piece of research that was done 7 years ago. Well, now I've discovered that this big piece of research has since been updated, because they've kept following the children, and what they've discovered is that although it works very well in the short term, after 2 or 3 years, it really stops working. But GPs don't know that. I don't know when this will be communicated to them. I know that GPs won't stop prescribing it just because they've seen it on Panorama. And also, because when something becomes received wisdom, it's very difficult to turn that around. So if a doctor thinks it works, you see, this is always the curious thing. They talk about practicing evidence-based medicine, but an awful lot of it for doctors, just like any other walk of life, is gut. And if you haven't seen something very bad happen, then you sort of assume the best, particularly if you've been told officially that it works. So, you know, you've got this situation now. I think we spent £28 million last year on ADHD medication, and it doesn't look like it works over the long term. I mean, that's what the science is saying, but I bet you it will take an age for clinical practice to catch up with that, because the first story that I told you about that I did before antidepressants, the tranquilizers one, that was exactly the point that we made in it. So doctors were warned, I think it was in the mid 80s, after there was a period, I think, at which 30 million prescriptions were written for Valium and all the other tranquilizers, and it had got a bit out of hand, and new guidelines were drawn up, and doctors were told you shouldn't prescribe Valium, Temazepam, Mogadon for any longer than 6 weeks at a time because they're addictive. And that's been, you know, that has been set in stone for 23 years. So when we decided to look at it in the year 2000, we commissioned an opinion poll to try and find out how many people were actually still addicted to tranquilizers, because we kept getting these anecdotal reports that lots of people were still hooked on these drugs. And I was thinking, but they can't be. How can they be? Doctors know that they're not supposed to prescribe them for more than 6 weeks. Well, we discovered that there's 1.5 million people in Britain addicted to tranquilizers. And that can only be because doctors aren't following the guidelines. And it's a really big problem. And I'm not saying it's all their, you know, it's too easy just to say that they're being lazy. I don't think they are being lazy. I think, what do you do in a 10-minute consultation? No, but if somebody, so there was a good example I was given during that program of, you know, an old lady who, you know, lived in a horrible council estate, and she couldn't sleep, and her neighbours, you know, were the neighbours from hell, and, you know, she goes to her doctor, she can't sleep. What's he going to do? What can he do? He can't sort out her social problems. You know, he does what he thinks is best for her in an individual case-by-case basis, but that all adds up in the end to a whole bunch of people hooked on a drug that they really probably shouldn't be taking. So it's a very big problem, and I don't know what the answer is. I know that NICE, you know, National Institute for Clinical Excellence, are supposed to look at, I mean, a lot of people are very cynical about them because, you know, they say it's all driven by money. But in one sense, you should really be looking to see whether a treatment is cost effective, because if it doesn't work, what's the point in spending money on it? So, you know, you would hope that eventually, that's what they keep doing, but they produce more and more guidelines. So then that's more and more for the doctors to read, who are already busy anyway. So I don't know. It's a bit of a conundrum.
We've run into the discipline of time, and I'm not going to allow Jason Craig to get me into trouble again this week. 30 seconds of advice to ingenues, to trainee people who want to be journalists.
Well, if you want to be a journalist, I would say go into long form television investigations because it's the most interesting area. I've worked in newspapers, I've worked in television news, and this is where you really, really, really get your teeth stuck into a story and you can actually make a difference. And that's the most satisfying thing at the end of the day, when you've stuck at it with a story and you actually see things change as a consequence. So, you know, I would say don't be lured by the glamour of television news and sort of quick hits. You know, it might not be the most glamorous job in the world and you do have to work terribly hard and you don't have a social life, but it's worth it in the end, I think.
And in fact, you've got a family tradition, haven't you? You your brother-in-law is a secret policeman.
Oh, Mark, yeah, Mark. He was the secret policeman,
was the secret policeman. Before I thank Shelley, just to reiterate, next week, two wonderfully distinguished old ladies talking about women's journalism. The week after, Andrew Davis. The week after, Will Wyatt on a Wednesday, and a man from Blitz Games on a Thursday. Everybody knows which direction we're going. Shelley's flown down from Scotland today. Can we thank her very much indeed, please?
This podcast is brought to you by Coventry University. To find out more, visit www.coventry.ac.uk.